property, roughly 5 acres, consists of a dense grove of banana trees. Also, ancient lignum vitae, kapok, and fragrant cedar trees. Only a narrow and rutted sandy lane gives one a clue as to Tea Kettle's existence. A drive, resembling a green tunnel, finally arrives at the house, but only after winding through the densely planted groves. Upon first glimpse, you realize the cottage actually does look like a tea kettle. The main portion is a rounded dome, formerly a limestone millworks. A crooked white-bricked watchtower on the far seaward side of the house forms the tea kettle's spout. The whole unassuming affair stands out on a rocky promontory, with waves crashing against the coral reef some 50 feet below. Inside the dome is an oval whitewashed living room. The floors are highly polished, well-worn Spanish red tile. Wrought iron chandeliers and sconces provide the light. The owner has furnished the main room with old planter's chairs and assortment of cast-offs and gifts donated by various residents seeking their own dream of solitude at the cottage over the last century or so. Douglas Fairbanks Jr., one of cinema's first icons, had donated the massive carved monkey wood bar after a long liquid stay when his first wife, Joan Crawford, had thrown him out. Tea Kettle was as good a place as any to hide out. The battered mahogany canasta table, where most of the indoor meals were taken, was a gift from Errol Flynn. The swashbuckling Flynn took refuge here during his stormy divorce from Lily DeMita. Hemingway had left his Underwood typewriter on the guest room desk where he'd completed work on Islands in the Stream. It stands there in his honor to this day. The shortwave radio set on the bar had been used by Admiral Sir Donald Gunn during World War II to monitor the comings and goings of Nazi U-boats just offshore from the cottage. A lot of less celebrated visitors had left behind the detritus of decades, much of which had been severely edited by the new owner. He wasn't a fussy man, but he'd pulled down all the pictures of snakes some prior inhabitant had hung in his small bedroom. He didn't mind disorder as long as it was his disorder. The owner of this rather eccentric dwelling is Lord Alexander Hawk. Hawk won't tolerate your use of his title and has never used it himself. The only one who is allowed to do so is his ancient friend and household retainer, Pelham Grenville, a man whom he has known since birth and is, with the exception of his young son, Alexei, the closest approximation to family he can claim. Hawk was now a man in his early 30s, a noticeable man, well north of 6 feet, with broad shoulders, a narrow waist, and a heroic head of unruly jet-black hair. A thick black comma of hair fell across his forehead despite his best efforts to keep it in check. His glacial blue eyes, a female friend had once decided they looked like pools of frozen rain, were startling. His eyes had a flashing range from merriment and charm to profound earnestness. Cross him, and he could fire a searing flash of blue across an entire room. Hawk had a high, clear brow and a straight, imperious nose above a well-sculpted mouth with just a hint of cruelty at the corners of a smile. His job, senior counterintelligence officer at Britain's MI6, demanded that he stay fit. Though he had a weakling for Mr. Gosling's local rum and Moreland's custom-blend cigarettes, he watched his diet and followed his old Royal Navy fitness regime religiously. He also swam 6 miles a day in open ocean every day. Attractive? Yes. But it was his what-the-hell grin, a look so freighted with charm that no woman and even few men could resist, that made him the man he was. A hail fellow well met, whom men wanted to stand to drink, and whom women much preferred horizontal. Hawk had been dozing out on the coquina-shell terrace that fanned out from the doors and flung open to the sea on a blue day like this. He had nothing on for today, just supper with his dear friends, the former chief inspector of Scotland Yard, Ambrose Congreve, and his fiancée, Lady Diana Mars, at their Bermuda home, Shadowlands, at 7 that evening.
"Sorry to disturb you, my lord,"
Pelham Grenville said, having shimmered across the sunlit terrace unseen.
Then don't,
Hawk said, deliberately keeping his eyes closed against the fierce sun. Pelham was the octogenarian valet who'd been in service to the Hawk family in England for decades. When Hawk was but 7 years old, he had witnessed his parents' tragic murder by modern-day drug pirates aboard their yacht in the Caribbean. Pelham and Chief Inspector Ambrose Congreve had immediately stepped in to raise the devastated child. No one who'd survived that lengthy process would claim that it was easy, but the three men had all remained the closest of friends ever since. Inseparable and insufferable, as they like to think of themselves these days.
I think you might wish to take this call, sir,
Pelham said. Really? Why?
It's your friend, the director, my lord.
I have many friends who are directors, Pelham. Which one?
CIA, sir. Says it's rather important.
You're joking. Rick Kelly.
On the line, as we speak, sir.
Thank you. Please tell him I shall be right there. Hawk had met CIA Director Kelly in an Iraqi prison. Kelly was a U.S. Army Special Ops Colonel back then, a man who'd been caught red-handed trying to assassinate a Sunni warlord in his mountain village. And Hawk's Royal Navy fighter plane had been shot down over the desert only a few miles from the Iraqi prison. Their treatment was less than 5-star. It was a no-mince-on-the-pillow operation. The guards were inhuman, sadistic, and merciless. One night, Kelly had been dragged away from their cell. He had looked so broken and weak that Hawk decided he'd not survive another day of malnutrition and torture. That very night, Hawk planned and managed to effect an escape, killing most of the guards and destroying half the prison in the doing of it. He carried Brick Kelly on his shoulders out into the burning desert. It was 4 long days before they were rescued by friendlies, both men delirious with hunger, sunstroke, and dehydration. It's the kind of defining experience that brings men of a certain caliber together for the balance of their lives. He and Brick had been thick as thieves ever since. Hawk went inside and over to the antique black fake-like phone sitting atop the far end of the monkey bar. He picked up the receiver. Hello? He said. By force of habit, he was always noncommittal when answering a phone call. Hawk? Brick? It's a secure line, Alex, no worries. I know you're laying low for a while. Well-deserve R&R. I called your house number in London to get this one. Sorry to even bother you, but something's happened I felt you should know about.
Trouble?
No, not exactly. Sadness is more like it. Alex, your old friend Cameron Hooker died this past weekend.
Hook died? Was he sick?
Never said a word.
No, it was an accident.
Oh, hell, Rick. Damn it, what happened?
I went for a sail on Sunday morning up at his house in Maine. Did it every Sunday of his life, apparently. When he wasn't back home by noon and his wife couldn't reach his cell, Jillian called the sheriff. They found the boat run aground on a small island near Stonington. Hook was aboard in the stern, dead.
Heart attack? Stroke?
His head was bashed in.
Foul play?
No, he was alone, apparently. At least, he was when he left the dock, according to a young fellow hired for the summer.
What happened?
I don't know much about sailing, Alex, as you well know. Apparently, he attempted some kind of an accidental tack in heavy wind, and the big wooden boom swung around and hit him in the head.
Jibe?
Right, that's the word the boy used. It was blowing pretty good, I suppose. Certainly enough force for something that heavy to kill him, but...
But what?
I hate to even bring this up, Alex, but in the last 6 weeks, a number of other high-level agency guys of his era have died. Lou Gagosian, Taylor Green, Max Cohen, and Nikolai Perugia.
Suspicious deaths, any of them?
No, not on the surface anyway. No evidence of foul play at all. It's just the sheer number and timing that's troublesome, and the high number may just be coincidence.
Or maybe not.
Something like that, yeah.
You want me to look into it?
No, not yet, anyway. All these poor widows and families are still in mourning.
and I don't really have any degree of certainty about my suspicions, just usual extrasensory paranoia. But, yeah, but, look here. Hook was a good friend of mine, Brick. If someone killed him, I damn well want to find out who. I'm sure you do it. I'll tell you what. Let's give it a month or so, see what happens. Anything suspicious crops up, we go full bore. Okay with you? Sure. You know best. When's the funeral? Where? Up at Hook's place. Cranberry Farm in Maine. Family cemetery on the property. Service is next Friday afternoon at 2, North Haven Island. Out in Penobscot Bay, east of Camden. If you're gonna fly up from Bermuda, there's a private airstrip at the old Tom Watson place. Oh, I've used it a few times, but thanks. Oh, that's right, I forgot you've been out there before. Okay, then I'll see you there then. All right, sorry, Alex. I know you two guys were close. And I'm sorry too, Brick. Last of the old breed. He was a very, very good guy. See you there. Chapter 4. Most afternoons, Harding Torrance walked home from work. His cardiac guy had told him walking was the best thing for his heart. He liked walking. He also liked walking in Paris. The women, you know. Paris had the world's most beautiful women, full stop, hands down. Plus, his 8-room apartment was on the Rue du Faubourg Saint-Honoré, a famous street in one of the fancier arrondissements on the right bank. He'd lived there over 20 years and still didn't know which arrondissement was which. He had learned an expression in French early on and had always served him well in life. Je ne sais quoi. I don't know. His homeward route from the office took him past the Ritz Hotel, Sotheby's, Hermès, Cartier, etc., etc. You get the picture. Ritzy real estate. Very ritzy. Oddly enough, the ritziest hotel on the whole Rue was not the one called the Ritz. It was the one called Hotel Le Bristol. What he liked about the Bristol, mainly, was the bar. At the end of the day, good or bad, he liked a quiet cocktail or two in a quiet bar before he went home to his wife. That was all there was to it, been doing it all his life, his personal happy hour. The Bristol bar was dimly lit, church quiet, and hidden away off the beaten path. It was basically a nook in the far corner of the lobby, where only the cognoscente, as they say, held sway. Torrance held sway there because he was a big, good-looking guy, always impeccably dressed in Savile Row threads and Chauvet shirts of pale pink or blue. He was a big tipper, a friendly guy, knew the bar staff's names by heart, and discreetly handed out envelopes every Christmas. Sartorial appearances to the contrary, Harding Torrance was 100% red-blooded American. He even worked for the government, had mostly all his life. And he'd done very, very well, thank you. He'd come up the hard way, but he'd come up all right. His job, though he'd damn well have to kill you if he told you, was station chief, CIA, Paris. In other words, Hardy was a very big damn deal in anybody's language. He'd been at Paris since right after 9/11. His buddy from Houston, the new president, had posted him there because the huge Muslim population in Paris present a lot of high-value intel opportunities in one concentrated location. His mandate was to identify the Al-Qaeda leadership in France, whisk them away to somewhere nice and quiet for a little enhanced interrogation. He was good at it. He stuck with it. He got results. And he got promoted. Boom, boom, boom. The president had even singled him out for recognition and a State of the Union address. Had specifically said that he and his team were responsible for saving countless lives on the European continent and in the UK. Harding had gone into the family oil business after West Point and a stint with the Rangers out of Fort Bragg. Spec ops duty. 2 combat tours in Iraq. Next, working for Torrance Oil, he was all over Saudi and Yemen and Oman, running his daddy's fields in the Middle East. But he was no silver spoon boy, far from it. He had started on the rigs right at the bottom rung, working as a ginsel, lower than the lowest worm, and working his way up to a floor hand on the Kelly driver, and then a bona fide driller in 1 year. Oil fields were his introduction to the real world of Islam. Long story short, he knew the Muslim mindset, their language, their body language, their brains even. Knew the whole culture, the warlords, where all the bodies were buried, the whole enchilada. And so, when his pal W needed someone uniquely qualified to transform the CIA Paris station into a first-rate intelligence clearinghouse for all of Europe, well, who was he to say? Let history tell the tale. His competition? Most guys inside the agency working in Europe at that time, right after the Twin Towers, didn't know a burqa from a kumquat. And that's no lie. Chapter 5. Monsieur Torrance? Monsieur Torrance?
Oui?
Votre whisky, monsieur. Oh, hey, Maurice, sorry. Yeah, Scotch rocks, he said to the head bartender.
Mais certainement, Monsieur Torrance, et voilà.
His drink had come like magic. Had he already ordered that? He knocked it back, ordered another, and relaxed, making small talk, le bavardage, with Maurice about the rain, the train bombing in Marseille, which horse might win 4 million euros in the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe at Longchamp tomorrow. The favorite was an American thoroughbred named Buckpasser. He was a big pony, heralded in the tabloids as the next Secretariat, Maurice told him. There will never, ever be another Big Red, Maurice. Trust me on that one.
But of course, sir, who could argue?
He swiveled on his bar stool, sipping his third or fourth scotch, checking the scenery, admiring his fellow man and woman. Wouldn't you know it? It was a rainy Friday night, and he told his wife, Julia, not to expect him for dinner. Something troubling had come up with the state visit of the new Chinese president to the Elysee Palace on Sunday, and something really bad had come up, but...
Sorry, is the seat taken?
She said. What the hell? He hadn't even seen her come in. Not at all, not at all. Here, let me remove my raincoat from the bar stool. How rude of me.
Thank you.
Très chic, he registered. Very elegant. Blonde. Big American girl. Swimmer, maybe, judging by the shoulders. California. Stanford. Maybe UCLA. One of the two. Pink Chanel, head to toe. Big green Hermès Kelly bag, all scruffed up, so loaded. Big rock on her finger, so married. A small wet puffball of a dog and a dripping umbrella, so ducked in out of the rain. Ordered a martini, so a veteran. Beautiful eyes and a fabulous body, so a possibility. He bought her another drink. Champagne this time. Domaine Haute Rosé, so she had taste. What brings you to Paris, Mrs.?
I'm Crystal.
And you are?
Harding.
Harding? Well, that's a good strong name, isn't it? So, why are we here? Let me see. Oh, yes, horses. My husband has horses. We're here for the races at Longchamp. And that 4 million euro purse, I'll bet. Maurice and I were just talking about that. Some payday, huh? Your horse have a shop? I suppose. I don't like horses. I like to shop. That a girl. Sound like my ex. So, where are you from, Crystal?
We're from Kentucky. Louisville? You know it?
Not really. So, where are you staying?
Right upstairs, honey. My hubby took the penthouse for the duration.
Got it. He's meeting you here, is he?
Hardly. Having dinner with his trainer somewhere in the Bois de Boulogne out near the track is more like it. The two of them are all juned up about Buckpasser running on a muddy track tomorrow.
You ask a lot of questions, don't you, Hardy?
It's my business.
Really? What do you do?
I'm a writer for a quiz show.
She smiled.
That's funny.
It's an old joke. You're smart, aren't you, Harding? I like smart men. Are you married?
No. Well, yes.
See, you are funny. May I have another pink champagne?
Harding twirled his right index finger, signaling the barman for another round. He briefly tried to remember how many scotches he'd had and gave up.
Cute dog, he said, bending down to pet the pooch, hating how utterly pathetic he sounded, but hell, he was hooked. Hooked, gaffed, and in the boat. He'd
Already crawled through a mile of broken glass just to drink this gal's bathwater.
Thanks, she said, lighting a gold-tipped cigarette with a gold DuPont lighter. She took a deep drag and let it out, coughing a bit.
So, you enjoy smoking? Harding said.
No, I just like coughing.
Good one. Then what's the little guy's name? He asked, looking down at the little drowned rat trying to pass for a pooch.
It's a her, Ricky Nelson.
Oh, you mean like,
right. In the Aussie and Harriet reruns, only this little bitch on wheels likes her name spelled with two K's, like Ricky Martinez, don't you, precious?
Yes, you do.
Who?
The singer?
Oh, sure.
Who?
Never mind, honey. Ain't no thing.
Right, so, shopping. What else do you like, Crystal?
Golf. I'm a scratch golfer.
Oh, and jewelry. I really like jewelry.
Golfer, huh?
You heard the joke about Arnold Palmer's ex-wife?
No, but I'm going to, I guess.
So this guy marries Arnold Palmer's ex. After they make love for the third time on their wedding night, the new groom picks up the hotel phone. Who you calling? Arnie's ex asks.
Room service, he says. I'm starved.
Well, that's not what Arnold would have done, she says. So the guy says, okay, what would Arnold have done?
Well, Arnold would have done it again, that's what.
And so they did it again. And then the guy picks up the phone again, and she says, you calling room service again? And he says, no, baby, I'm calling Arnold. Find out what par is on this damn hole.
He waited.
I don't get it.
Well, see, he's calling Arnold because,
she said, putting her index finger to her lips. She covered his large hand with her small one and stroked the inside of his palm with her index finger. She put her face close to his and whispered, frankly, let's just cut the shit. I like sex, Harding.
Well, that's funny. I do too, he said.
I bet you do, baby.
I warn you, though, I'm a big girl, Harding. I'm a big girl with big appetites.
I wonder, did you read 50 Shades of Grey?
Must have missed that one, sorry. Did you ever read Mark Twain?
No, who wrote it?
Doesn't matter. Tell me about 50 Shades of Grey.
Doesn't matter, I found it terribly vanilla, she said.
Yeah.
Right, that's what men always say when they don't know what the hell a girl is talking about.
Well, vanilla, not kinky enough.
Not bad, Harding. Know what they used to say about me at my sorority house at UCLA, the Kappa Delts?
I do not.
That Crystal. She's got big hair and big knockers, and she likes big sex.
He turned to face her and took both her perfect hands in his.
I'm sorry, would you ever, in your wildest dreams, consider leaving your rich husband and marrying a poor homeless boy like me?
No.
Had to ask. I would, however, consider inviting you upstairs to view my etchings. I like to screw.
You do get that part, right?
Duly noted.
Long as we're square on this, Harding.
We're square.
I'm going to tie you to the bed and make you squeal like Porky Pig, son.
Or vice versa. You with me on this?
He looked at her and smiled.
Jackpot.
Chapter 6.
The elevator to the penthouse suite opened inside the apartment foyer. It was exquisite, just as Harding would have imagined the best rooms in the best hotel in Paris might be, full of soft evening light, with huge arrangements of fresh flowers everywhere, and through the open doors a large terrace overlooking the lights of Paris and the misty gardens below. Crystal smiled demurely and led him into the darkened living room. She showed him the bar and told him to help himself. She'd be right back. Slipping into something a little more comfortable, he imagined, smiling to himself as he poured two fingers of Johnny Walker Blue and strolled over to a large, very inviting sofa by the fireplace. Kicked his shoes off, stretched out, and took a sip of whiskey. He was just getting relaxed when he heard an odd hissing sound. Looking down to the floor, he saw that the little fuckhead Ricky Nelson had just peed all over his Gucci's.
Shit, he said under his breath.
Hey, he heard her call out.
What?
Turn on some music, Harding. I want to dance. She called out from somewhere down a long, dark hall. He got to his feet and staggered a few feet in the gloom, cracking his shin on an invisible marble coffee table. What? Music, where is it? It's right below the bar glasses. Just push on. It's already loaded up and ready to rip. He limped over to the bar and hit the button. Dean Martin's That's Amore filled the room. Is that it? He shouted over Dino. Hell yes, son. Crank it. He somehow found the volume control, cranked it, went out to the terrace, away from the bar's booming overhead speakers. The rain was pattering on the drooping awning overhead, and the night smelt like... Like what? Jasmine? No, that wasn't it. Well, something, anyway. It definitely smelled like something out here. Hey, you! She shouted from the living room's open doorway. There he is! There's my big stud! Come on in here, son. Let's dance. Waltz your ass in here, baby boy, right now. He downed his drink and went inside. Crystal stood in the center of the room wearing a skin-tight, black leather bodysuit that would have put Catwoman to shame. She had little Ricky Nelson cuddled in her arms, nuzzling her with kisses. Where's the whip? He said. Oh, I'll dig one up somewhere. Don't you worry. Harding collapsed into the nearest armchair and stared. Why are you staring like that at me and Ricky? She pouted. I'm just trying to figure out whether or not that leash is on the wrong bitch. Give her credit, she laughed. I sure as hell you know how to dance, mister, she said. Now get up and get with it. I mean it. He hauled himself manfully up out of the leather chair. You do what you have to do, he reminded himself, and he danced and danced some more. Chapter 7. He was drenched in sweat and panting like an old bird dog. Even the sheets were wet. Somehow he'd managed to give her three big O's, two traditional, and lastly, one utterly exhausting one. He'd never worked so hard in his life. Outside the box, she called it, that last one. He managed a weak smile. Wow, you are something else, aren't you, girl? I need a cigarette. No time, back in the saddle, cowboy. You got me hot now, and I'm itching to ride. Crystal, seriously, I need a little breather here. Don't be a pussy, Harding. Mama's waiting. Turn over. Oh, Christ. He rolled over onto his back and stared at the ceiling. She took his wrists and tied him to the bedpost with two Hermes scarves she'd plucked from the bedside table. He didn't even bother trying to fight her. Are you trying to kill me or what? Don't you worry yourself, baby. The Cialis will kick in any minute now. I don't take Cialis, Crystal. Well, you do now, stud. I put two in your drink down in the hotel lobby bar when you bent down to pat Ricky Nelson. What? Are you kidding me? For Christ's sake, Crystal. No, don't say I didn't warn you, hon. Big sex, remember? Okay, I'll get on top this time. Oh, yes, somebody's ready for Mama down there. That Cialis is a bitch, isn't it? Just think, two pills, you might have an erection lasting 8 hours. Listen, Crystal, you really got to stop this. Untie me. I got a pain in my chest. No, I mean it. Pussy is the best cure for whatever ails you, son. Now, hang on. Mama's going to ride this bucking bronco all the way to the buzzer. No, damn it, get off. I've got a cardiac condition. Doc says I'm supposed to take it easy. God damn it, I'm serious. Now, my arm really hurts. Now, call the doctor, Crystal. Now, they must have a house doctor on call. Christ almighty, it hurts. Do something. Well, like what? My pills, my nitro pills. They're over there in my trouser pocket. Hold on a sec. She reached over and picked up the bedside phone, never breaking her stride, and asked for the hotel operator. Chapter 8. He must have passed out from the pain. Everything was foggy, out of focus. The room was dark, the rain beating hard against the window panes. Just a single lamplight from a table over in the corner.
Crystal, still naked, was sitting with her back to him at the foot of the bed, smoking a cigarette and talking to the doctor in hushed tones. Her head was resting on the doctor's shoulder. He couldn't make out what they were saying. He was bathed in a cold, clammy sweat, and the pain had spread from behind his breastbone into and out along his left arm. Fucking hell. His wrists were still tied to the bedposts? Was she insane? He heard a sob escape from his own lips, and then a cry of pain caused by the elephant sitting atop his chest. "Shh," the doctor said, getting to his feet and coming to the head of the bed to stand beside him. He was naked, too. He put his finger to his lips and said, "Shh," again.
"You gotta do CPR or something, Doc," Harding croaked. "My pills, they're in the right pocket of my trousers, please. I feel like I'm gonna die."
"That's because you are going to die, Harding," the man said.
"What?"
"You heard me."
"Wait.
Who are you?"
He squinted his eyes, but he couldn't make out the physician's features.
"Vengeance, saith the Lord, Harding. That's who I am. Vengeance."
"You're not a doctor. You're..."
"A Dr. Death will do for now."
"Who? No, you're... not! You're somebody else! You're..."
"Don't you recognize me anymore, Harding? I've had a little surgery recently, a bit of Botox, but still, the eyes are a dead giveaway. Look close."
"Spider?"
"Bingo."
"No, can't be your fucking spider, for Christ's sake,"
the dying man croaked.
"Right. Spider Payne. Your old buddy. Come rain or come shine. Tonight it's rain. Look out the window, Harding. It's goddamn pouring out there. Ever see it rain so hard?
Give me a break here, Spider. What are you doing?"
"It's called poetic justice. Little twist of fate, shall we say."
Pain scorched Torrance's body, and he arched upward, straining against his bonds, coming almost completely off the bed. He didn't think anything could hurt this much. His old nemesis knelt on the floor by the bed and started gently stroking his hair. When he spoke, it was barely above a whisper.
"You fucked me royally, Harding. Remember that? When I needed you most? When the French government, whom you always claimed to have in your pocket, nailed my balls to the wall? Kidnapping and suspicion of murder? 30 years to life, ring a bell?"
"It wasn't my... fault, for Christ's sake, please, you gotta help me."
"That's my line. Help me. You don't get to use it. Way too late for that, I'm afraid, old soldier. You're catching the next train, partner."
I can't breathe. I can't catch my..."
"Well, this is how it works, Harding."
"What?"
"Well, it's so simple, isn't it? Judgment Day. How it all works out in the end. In that dark hour when no bad deed goes unpunished."
I can't.
Harding Torrance opened his eyes wide in fear and pain. And as the blackness closed in around him, he heard Spider Payne utter the last words his addled brain would ever register.
You fuck me, right? But in the end, Crystal and the spider, they fuck you."
Chapter 9. A perfect day for a funeral. It was raining steadily but softly, dripping from the leaves, dripping from the eaves of the old main cottage on the hill. Tendrils of misty gray fog curled up from the sea, only to disappear into the steaming pine forests. Thin, ragged clouds scudded by low overhead. Hook's burial service was in the overgrown family plot, a hallowed patch of small, worn gravestones dotting a hilltop clearing overlooking the misty harbor. There were rows and rows of folding white chairs arranged on the grass surrounding the graveside, filled with mourners hidden beneath rows and rows of gleaming black umbrellas. There was even a piper in full regalia, standing by the freshly opened wound in the rich earth. A white-bearded fellow wearing tartans, an old friend of Hook's, who'd rode over from Vinylhaven for the 3 o'clock service. At the center of it all, a yawning grave. Alex Hawk was seated in the very last row beside his old American friend Brick Kelly. Hawk let his eyes wander where they would, taking it all in, the simple beauty of the rainy day and the still and perfect sadness all around him. Down at the dock, Hook's black ketch was flying signal flags from stem to masthead to stern, thanks to the young man whom Hawk had just met up at the house, a good-looking college kid Cam Hooker had hired to look after his boat that summer. The boy was sitting a few rows ahead of him with the grandchildren now, trying to keep them still. Hawk had first seen the boy up at the house trying to catch his eye all morning. Finally, Hawk said,
"Can I help you?"
"You're Lord Hawk, is that correct, sir?" the boy had asked as they stood together. They were both holding plates, everyone inching forward in the buffet line circling through the living room and dining rooms. Both rooms were full of musty old furniture, cracked marine paintings, and frayed rugs made all the more beautiful by age and deliberate lack of care.
"I am indeed," Hawk said, puzzled.
Why should anyone here know who he was? He stood out, he supposed, in his uniform. Royal Navy blue number one dress, no sword. Bit of a spectacle, but nothing for it. It was regulation.
"Ben Sparhawk, sir. I worked for Director Hooker this past summer, helping out with Marakaya and around the dock. I wonder if we might have a word, sir."
"Of course. What about?"
The fellow looked around and lowered his voice. "I'd really rather not discuss it here, if you don't mind, sir."
Hawk looked at the long line of people slowly snaking toward the buffet table set up in the dining room.
"Let's go out into the porch and get some air," the Englishman said. "Not really hungry, anyway."
"Thank you,"
Ben Sparhawk replied, somewhat shakily. He followed the older man outside into the damp air, misty rain blowing about under the eaves.
"I really appreciate your taking the time."
"Something's bothering you, Ben?" Hawk said, his hands on the railing, admiring Camden Harbor across the bay and the beautiful main coastline visible from the hilltop.
"Just relax. Tell me what it is."
"Well, I really don't know quite where to start." It occurred to Hawk that he'd always loved this part of the world, that someday he would very much like to own an old house up here. The late summer air full of white clouds and diving white seabirds, the endlessly waving tops of green forests, the deep rolling swells of the blue sea. Bermuda was lovely, but it wasn't this. For the first time, he understood viscerally what his old friend Hook had known and cherished all his life. Down East Maine was closer to heaven than most places you could name. And you probably couldn't even name one.
"I'm sorry, sir. I don't know the proper form of address I should use. Is it your lordship?"
"It's Alex, Ben. Just plain old Alex." The handsome young man smiled. "Well, first of all, I haven't said a word to anyone about what I'm going to tell you, I mean. But I know who you are, and I figured you'd be someone who'd listen. Mr. Hooker talked a lot about you, all the sailing you two had done up here over the years, Northeast Harbor, Nova Scotia, Transatlantic."
"We had some good times," Hawk said,
wistful for those fleeting moments, sadly missing his old friend. "So he often said. Hook always claimed his friend Hawk was the finest blue water sailor he'd ever known, sir. But he was a good sailor, too, wouldn't you say? I was only aboard with him a couple of times out in the bay, but you can tell, right?"
"Absolutely.
Hook was a lifelong salter, ever there was one. Still competitive in the Bermuda race until a few years ago. Why?
What's troubling you?"
"Okay, here goes. There's just no way on earth I can see what happened out there in the water as accidental. None."
"Why?"
"Well, here's the thing, sir. On the day it happened, well, it was blowing pretty good out there, all right. It was steady at 15, gusting to 25, 30 knots. But nothing Cam Hooker couldn't handle. Had I thought otherwise, I would have volunteered to go with him. Not that he would have let me, but still."
"Go on." Well, I know accidents happen at the sea all the time, sir. I've had my share, but what I cannot understand, what I do not understand, is why on earth Cam Hooker would jibe that big boat out there all alone, blowing like stink. I'm sure you'd agree it's the last thing he would do.
A jibe?
Yes, I heard that. Had to be an accident. Why the hell would he do that? Answer, he wouldn't. That beats me, sir. Jibe. It's the dead last thing anyone would do in a blow, especially someone elderly and sailing single-handed.
I agree.
What makes you think that that's what happened? Okay, here's what I know. I had a few beers down at Nebo's the other night with Jimmy Brown. He's the chief of police here on the island, and he told me that when they found Marikaya, she'd drifted a while and finally run aground on the rocks out there on Horseshoe Neck Island. The main sheet, which Cam would have obviously kept cleated, was free. Why? Also, from where Cam was found, the position of the body near the gunwale, it was clear the boom must have knocked him completely out of the cockpit. And he was not a small man, sir.
Hawk nodded his head, seeing it happen. That much force could only have resulted from an accidental jibe.
Yes, sir. And it was no glancing blow, either. His skull was. But it was almost completely disintegrated. Ben Sparkhawk looked away, his eyes filling up. Damn it, sir, I'm sorry. I just don't buy it. Accident, human error, Cam's old age, dementia, all that police bullcrap, what they're saying in town.
Well, what do you think really happened, Ben?
Well, look, maybe I'm crazy. I don't know. But to tell you the truth, murder. I think someone murdered him.
Murder's a strong word.
I know. No idea how it happened, no idea why. But you asked me what I think, and now you know.
No. Take me through it, Ben, step by step. I'll ask you a few questions. Any information you think I need to have, give it to me. Can you do that?
Absolutely, sir.
All right, first. He was alone on board when he left the dock, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And he sailed out of your sight alone?
He did.
But once around the point down there, he could have seen a friend on the town docks, or someone on another boat in the harbor could have hailed him over. He could have stopped to let them aboard, a friend along for the ride or something.
But he could have, but...
But what?
But he just never would have done it. Sunday was his day. He treasured every second he got to spend alone aboard that old boat. He didn't go to church, you know. That boat was his church, his place of refuge. You know what he said to me early on in the summer?
I don't.
He said, I discovered something about sailing at a very early age, Ben. Something about... The doing of it makes people want to keep their eyes and ears open and their goddamn mouths shut. I like that about it.
Hawk smiled. Well, he hated idle chit-chat, all right. Always said they called it small talk for a very good reason.
Yes, sir. He said sailing all alone had been his salvation as he grew older. And that's what I think he believed, anyway. I know he had a wonderful family, too. Hell, everyone on this island loved him. Look at them all.
But you think he never would have stopped to take someone else on board before he headed to open water?
Not unless they were drowning.
Which means the killer, if there was one, had to be hiding aboard when he left the dock last Sunday morning.
Had to be. Only way.
But you would have seen somebody hiding aboard, I mean?
Not really, sir. All I did below that morning was clean up the galley, plug in the espresso machine, check the fuel and water, turn on the battery switches. Didn't check the bilges, I didn't check the sail locker forward, no reason to really, but still. Wish you got ahead.
Yeah, don't even think of laying this off on yourself, Ben.
Well, I'm just saying, so.
When did you last check those two places?
The afternoon before. One of the bilge pumps needed rewiring, and I climbed down there, and I did that, and I bought some new running rigging from Foy Brown's. I stowed it forward in the sail locker until I could get around to it. Nothing in either place. No sign of anyone on board.
But it had to be a stowaway, Ben, if you're right about all this.
Yes, sir, it did. But where was he?
Hawk looked away to the horizon for a moment, thinking it through.
Well, assume that this is premeditated. He's been watching his victim for some time now. Knows all his habits, his routines. Like his weekly Sunday morning sail?
Exactly.
So, Saturday night, early Sunday morning. Our stowaway comes aboard in the wee hours when everyone's asleep, finds the boat unlocked, so he goes below, finds room enough to hide in the sail locker up at the bow, sleeps up forward on top of the sails, prays
No one needs a reason to open that hatch before she next left the dock.
That would work.
Comes up on deck after she clears the harbor, confronts his victim, has a gun or a knife, words are exchanged, sees how hard it's blowing, sees the opportunity for an accidental jibe. No one is around to see, realizes on the spot that he can make murder look like an accident. Ben nodded in the affirmative. Maybe Cam knows him, maybe he's not afraid of him. The killer stands there, talking in the cockpit, making Cam relax, let his guard down. And suddenly he frees the main sheet and puts the helm hard over. Wham, she jibes. Cam never saw the boom coming at him. Was there brain tissue found on the boom, Ben? Yes, sir, I think there was. I heard a cop say so, but I couldn't look. And then what happens? Looks around, makes sure he hasn't been seen, I guess. Leaves Cam lying there like that, maybe dead, maybe still alive, but not for long. He uncleats the main sheet, the jib sheet, lets her drift with the currents. How does he get off the boat? Water's freezing. Has a wetsuit sewed up in the sail locker and swims ashore? Ben said. Exactly. Are you thinking a native of North Haven? Cam have any enemies at all on this island, Ben? By that I mean serious enemies? No, sir. He did not. Had a few run-ins with plumbers and caretakers, the usual disagreements over money or the quality of work over the years, but as I say, most everybody who knew him loved him, and nobody hated him. I would have known. Everybody knows everything around here, believe me. So, comes over from the mainland by boat the day before, late Saturday night, let's say. His own boat, maybe, or a rental, or stolen in Camden Harbor, something to check out with your friends at the local constabulary. Sails over to North Haven from Rockport, or Camden. Hides his skiff somewhere along the shore for the night. Hikes out here to Cranberry Point sometime after midnight and climbs aboard the catch. Tucks in for the night. Main hatch leading below is not locked, I assume. Never. There's one other option. He takes the ferry from Rockland the afternoon before. Brings his car aboard. Or leaves it at the mainland ferry station, either way. You're right. So, we've established opportunity. All we need now is motive. Well, I reckon you know a lot more about that kind of thing than I do, sir. And I reckon I would, Ben. I don't CIA Director Brick Kelly sure does. But thank you for coming to me. It was the right thing to do. Does Cam's wife know anything about your suspicions? No, sir, she doesn't. I would never have said anything about what might still be a whole lot of nothing. You are the one and only person I've talked about this. I may need your help here on the island, Ben. I'll talk to the director after the funeral. Anything at all. I love the old guy, sir. I'm pretty sure you did, too. Look, Ben, I'm flying back to Bermuda first thing tomorrow morning. But if Brick Kelly and I both conclude that you're onto something here, I'd like you to stick around here in North Haven as long as you can, just in case we have any follow-up questions for the police chief or other things we'd like you to look into around here. When do you have to be back at New Haven? I've got a few weeks left before the fall term starts, sir. Good. I'll talk to Director Kelly tonight. If he concurs, you're working for the CIA now, Mr. Sparhawk. Just temporarily, of course. Yes, sir, Ben Sparhawk said with a smile. For a second, Hawk was afraid he was going to salute. Don't get too excited, Ben. You don't get the secret decoder ring just yet. Chapter 10. After the service, Hawk told Brick Kelly they needed to talk, something that couldn't wait until next morning. At first light, Hawk was giving the director a lift onto Washington in his plane. He would drop him off at Andrews Air Force Base before heading out over the Atlantic to his beloved getaway cottage on Bermuda. That evening, after the funeral, the two old friends strolled into town from the Hooker place. Jillian had been kind enough to put them up for the night in two tiny bedrooms up on the third floor. And they'd enjoyed spending the extra time together. They were quiet, admiring the lights coming in on the little village of North Haven and the old boatyards and the casino before climbing the hill to the Nebo Lodge. The inn overlooked the sailboats swinging on their moorings in the tranquil harbor. Nebo was the only restaurant on the island. It was a damn fine one, by Hawk's lights. They ate in the bar. It was packed with mourners drowning their sorrows. Hawk had once asked an old islander why folks seem to drink a lot around here.
Well, because, boy, there ain't nothing to do, and we spend all our time doing it.
was the fellow's response. Every face Hawk saw there that night he had seen earlier at Hook's funeral. No one paid the slightest mind to the two off-islanders talking quietly at a quarter table. Hawk had discreetly given the hostess a substantial gratuity to ensure no one was seated near them. Their drinks came, and Brick solemnly raised his glass of amber whiskey. "To Hook," the Virginian said, "none finer, and many a damn sight worse." "We loved you, Hooker," Hawk said simply, and downed his rum. "Sure as hell did," Brick said, and signaled the waitress for another round. He looked at Hawk, glad of his company. It had been far too long since they'd been able to spend a quiet evening together in a place like this. Something they used to do all the time, just bullshit and drink. Small talk would come later. They had business to discuss first. The tall and lanky Virginian settled back in his chair toward the window, his red hair aflame in the sunset's last rays, his sea-blue eyes alight. Brick had always had an old-fashioned, almost Jeffersonian air about him. He even looked a great deal like the young Tom Jefferson in the prime of his life. He looked at Hawk and smiled. "Well, old buddy, you said you had something to tell me," Brick said. "I do," Hawk said. "And you said you had something you wanted to tell me, you first." Brick Kelly laughed. "All right, Hawk. That's how you want to be. There was a message waiting for me up in my dorm room after the funeral. The deputy director at Langley, are you listening?" "Fire when ready." "Okay, my guy. CIA chief of station, Paris. You know him?" "Nope." "Guy named Harding Torrance, a lifer. Old friend of the Houston oil crowd, Bush 41 appointee." "I remember him now, yeah, big strapping fella, real cowboy as I recall." "Yeah, well, the real cowboy's real dead." Hawk sat forward. "Another one? Tell me what happened, Brick." "Died with his boots on, apparently, in bed in a suite at the Hotel Bristol in Paris. This was, roughly 6 hours ago now. Harding was with a woman, married, whom he'd just met in the hotel bar. Her room. She was a registered guest. All legit. You should know that this was not unusual behavior on his part. Torrance considered himself quite a swordsman. Neither here nor there, he never let it interfere with his work."
"Meaning?"
"Meaning he saved a lot of innocent lives in the aftermath of 9/11. That gets him a bit of a pass in my book."
"Cause of death?"
"Coronary. Big time. Massive. Happened in the sack. According to his newly acquired inamorata, Miss Crystal Saxby of Louisville, Kentucky, they were having sex when the event occurred. She says she immediately called for a house doctor and administered CPR while she was waiting, but it was too late. He was gone by the time anybody got there."
"So sad when love goes wrong," Hawk said, sipping his rum. Brick smiled.
"Yeah. Apparently the husband walked in while she was still nude, sitting on his chest and attempting mouth-to-mouth, but that's only hearsay. One of my guys in the scene provided that picturesque grace note." "Oh, what do you think, Breck? Foul play?" "I'll tell you this. The gendarmes and the Paris ME guys have already called it natural causes." "No sign of succinyl choline in his bloodstream? Or that new heart attack, Dart?" "No. I've ordered my own autopsy, nada on the drug so far. No denatured poisons and no sign of a dart entry."
"The heart dart leaves a mark? I didn't know that."
"Yeah, a tiny red dot on the skin, easy to miss, goes away quickly, though."
"So, clean?"
"Yeah, maybe. I still don't like the timing, but yeah, I suppose he just had a heart attack brought on by excessive sexual exertion. Happens all the time, I guess."
"What, you guess? You never guess.
What's wrong, Brick?
No, tell me. What do you really think?"
"Well, hell, I don't know, Alex. Maybe nothing. Maybe it is what it is. But a couple of troublesome details. My guys found heart meds in his pants pocket. Little silver heart-shaped pillbox from Tiffany, monogram. So, this coronary was no surprise attack. Nitro pills and beta blockers in his pocket? We checked. He's under the care of the top cardiac specialist in Paris. feels a heart attack coming on, the first thing he does, he tells the woman to call his doctor and go get him his damn meds, right? Like, right now? Anybody ask the woman that question? Well, they will tomorrow morning. I'm having her brought back to the prefecture for another interview. So, anyway, who the hell knows? That's my latest tale of mayhem and misery. Let's order some dinner and you tell me yours. Hawk took 10 minutes and told Kelly everything Ben Sparhawk had said about Cam Hooker's death while they waited for their food.
What are you thinking? Hawk asked Brick, after a few minutes of contemplative silence from his friend.
Question, Brick said.
Go.
Well, let's be realistic here. Could someone commit a fairly sophisticated murder here in Maine on Sunday and then pull off another one 4 days later in Paris? Even more elaborate? I mean, seriously, who the hell is good enough to pull that off?
Cam was a pretty tough act to follow, all right?
Hawk waited a bit and said, maybe we've got it all wrong. Can you connect any of these dots, Brick, between these two most recent guys and the other ones? Because I'm telling you right now that if we can't, well, mere coincidence starts to look pretty good again. Brick took a bite of his steak and said, well, don't go there yet. Stay open to it, but I hear you. I'm on the connect-the-dots issue as soon as I get back to the office tomorrow. I'll call your Bermuda number, and if and when I get any positive hits. Correlations, I mean. Chapter 11. The rain had stopped. After dinner at Nebo, Hawk and Brick walked back to the Hooker place, taking the main road along the harbor. There was a full moon, hanging bright and white and big in the sky. Each man knew what the other was thinking. There was no need of talking about it. Finally, as they turned into the long Hooker Drive, Brick stopped and looked at his friend. What's your gut telling you, Alex? Brick said. Right this minute. Don't edit. Spit it out. Okay, that the timing of all of this is no coincidence, that what you really got is a totally badass rogue agent running around the planet, systematically killing your own top guys.
Yeah, that's where I come out, too.
Well, let me find him for you, Brick.
Are you kidding? That's my problem, not yours. My agency, my people are getting killed. I mean, God knows MI6 has got enough of its own problems these days that Intel meltdown in Syria, for starters. This guy, whoever he is, killed my friend Hawk Brick. And that makes him my problem, too.
You're serious? You want to take this on?
I do.
You even have time to do this? I've got another 2 weeks before C wants me to mysteriously disappear in a Damascus souk looking to purchase some bargain basement sarin gas.
Brick looked at him and they started climbing the hill.
Well, 2 weeks isn't a long time to find a seasoned operative who's gone to ground without a trace. Now roaming the globe on a murder spree but not leaving any tracks. But listen, Alex, hell, I won't stop you from looking. Nobody is better at this than you. Just tell me what you need.
Oh, don't worry, I will. This is obviously not an MI6 operation, you're right.
And see, and the brass at MI6 will pitch a fit. They find out I've gone freelance. So I need somebody attached to this op at Langley. Files on every possible disaffected agent who had ties to multiple victims, for starters, active and inactive. Send everything to Bermuda. I'll get Ambrose Congreve on this with me. He's there at his home in Bermuda now, as luck would have it.
Your very own weapon of mass deduction. If he can't solve this, no one can.
Exactly. I'll tell you one thing, Brick said, never breaking his stride, but taking a deep breath and staring up at the blazing moon and cold stars. I'm really going to miss Hook, that old bastard, won't you, Alex?
Sure as hell will. But I'll feel a whole lot better when I can catch the son of a bitch who bloody killed him. I can tell you that bloody much. It won't be pretty.
Easy, he said. Easy there, old compadre.
Who the hell, I ask you, who the hell would ever want to murder a fine old Yankee gentleman like Hook?
Well, go find out, Alex, whoever it is he needs killing soon. I have a lot of justifiably nervous campers out there right now.
Yes, murder's bad for institutional morale.
Ambrose will have every shred of evidence I can pull together arrive at his Bermuda address by a courier within 48 hours.
Good. Sooner the better. A couple of weeks isn't a long time.
Chapter 12. It didn't take Ambrose that long.
Sorry to disturb you, sir,
Pelham said.
Not at all, Bill.
Chief Inspector Ambrose Congreve here to see you, sir,
Pelham said, wafting further out into the